accession number 27185, reel 50.
Major Barras, reel 50.
Do you remember any particularly significant events occurring while you were in post in Jamaica?
Oh, yes, there were quite a number. I arrived there in July, and in August I had my first trip abroad, down to Trinidad. I can't really remember why I went there, but I went there with the staff officer operations from the Admiral's Commander-in-Chief Atlantic Station. We went together. We did quite a lot of work together, actually. We had very close liaison with the Navy there. And we flew down to Trinidad, and I can remember as we went down, we had the sky was totally blacked on the one side, on the left-hand side. And this sailor friend of mine looked out of the window down at the sea, and he said there's a very, very high sea running down there. And when we arrived in Trinidad, we heard that a hurricane had hit, or was just about to hit, Jamaica, which we just left. So when we arrived in Trinidad, we were put up at Government House, which was a very large red brick imposing building. And the governor just arrived. He'd been opening Parliament or doing something, and was in full fig with his ostrich feathers and sword and everything else. He'd been riding in an open carriage, actually. It was with an escort of police in helmets. Very imposing. It had been raining, so he was a bit wet. But I just met him, and I realised that he was General Hubert Rance, who had been governor of Burma, who I knew there, off and on.
I remember you saying that during the time he was governor in Burma, a lot of decisions that had to be made in accordance with the advice of soothsayers.
And that's right, yes. Astronomy came into it.
Astrology.
Came into it. Oh, yes, they wanted to change the date of independence when it was more in keeping with the stars' positions. So he just went ahead and said, OK, let's do it, because it didn't matter to him when they had it. Anyway, so we had our meeting down there. I don't know why we went. It was obviously something to do with defence, because the naval chap was with me. And as I think I explained before, there are oil fields in Trinidad. There was also the US Navy base there, which was an aircraft, seaplanes mostly. And, of course, it was a place where bauxite from British Guiana was bought in ships, raw, processed at a place called Chegurama, I think it was, up the coast, and then reloaded into ships and taken up to Canada, because it was a Canadian company which dug out the aluminium, as they called it. So perhaps there were always a number of those things which we had to talk about. Anyway, we couldn't go back because the place had been bashed around in Jamaica, so we had to stay there a couple more days. And my abiding memory there is playing billiard fives with the governor, who insisted on playing this game each evening. With a very sore hands. I don't know whether you ever come across it before, but, you know the principle of fives, where you knock a ball around a court.
Yes.
Well, you do it on the billiard table. Instead of using rackets, you use your hands. So I think his hands must be more leathery than mine, because I was totally sore at the end of it. So we passed our evening like that. Anyway, we eventually, the sailor friend, I can't remember his name, actually. We got quite friendly. We were able to get back to Jamaica, and I can remember flying in over Jamaica and looking down and seeing all the coconut groves and banana groves over the area, which we flew, had been absolutely flattened, and all the trees had come down in line as they would have been if they were standing up.
Like dominoes.
Yeah. So they were all in a line on the ground, spaced out, as if they were still standing up. And then we flew over the airport, and that had been bashed around, because it was mostly corrugated iron in those days, and that was a hell of a mess.
Had you had any warning of this hurricane before you set
up? Not before we left, no. Nobody told us. There must have been a warning going around. It must have just missed us, I think. Because when we left Jamaica, it was quite clear.
Air Force was normally responsible for meteorology, wasn't it? Royal Air Force?
Well, we didn't have any Royal Air Force there. I don't know who was the... I think the Americans would probably have given us the information about movement of hurricanes.
Well, they would have to keep a fairly close watch, wouldn't they, for operational...
Oh, that's right,
reasons.
Yeah. But the hurricane season there, you see, is between the middle of July and the middle of November. Mm. So we had to get out special... I had to get out special orders of what happened in the case of a hurricane. And when I got back to the office, I found out that one of the left-hand corner, I think it was, of Jamaica had been very badly hit, Port Morant. And the army had already been deployed with radios and parties with tents, blankets and whatnot. Of course, not very much was happening from the government, the local council, rather.
I was going to ask, was there any sort of civil... rescue organisation based on the fire?
Not a lot. They really depended upon us initially. Eventually they turned up and took over because there was a lot of labour needed in moving stuff around. But on the way back from the airport, we did see a boat, for instance, which was on the road, which had just been shoved off the sea and was on the side of the road. Quite a sizable boat it was. I mean, it got a funnel on it. And a number of roofs of houses have been knocked about. And then after we'd been there, there was a rumour of another hurricane coming, so we all battened down the hatches again, but it didn't materialise. So that was my first trip abroad. I didn't don't think mentioned anything about the local government. Sir Hugh Foote was then governor. I think his brother is better known than he was, Michael Foote. And then there was Dingle. Hugh Foote, he was a very good governor. He was described by the brigadier, I think, as being slightly Cromwellian and Methodist all mixed together. Well, he came from a family, of course, which were very liberal in Cornwall, all of them. And he had two children, Hugh Foote. One was a Sarah and the other was Paul. Now, Paul Foote was a nice little schoolboy then, but when he now writes or has been writing very left-wing articles in papers and has become very left-wing indeed.
More radical.
More radical, and I think it would almost astonish his Uncle Dingle to hear, see what he's been doing. I don't think Uncle Dingle exists anymore. So we had meetings at, we used to go to Government House with the, I used to go accompany the brig there, when we just talk about the local political and security situation. And then I had to attend, I think it was once every month, a meeting on my own with the Colonial Secretary, which was the supporter of the governor. He's the sort of chief of staff, he's the one who did all this sort of hard
did he
work.
Deal with the police as well?
Oh, yes. Yes, there have been the police.
Liaison with the police?
Oh, I had plenty of liaisons you with did. The police. Oh, yes. Especially over internal security, hurricanes, and parades and all kinds of things we did in the... which involved the control of streets in the town and security.
Was there of any large-scale public disorder?
No. Not in Jamaica. I don't think there was any public... The only place, and I think I've mentioned it before, where there was any sign of internal trouble was in Grenada.
You mentioned British Guiana and Grenada as...
Well, British Guiana's from outside, from Guatemala.
That's Belize, wasn't it? British Honduras.
British Honduras, I mean, yeah. Yes, there was... Sorry, I beg your pardon. Mm-hmm. British Guiana did stir up trouble later on. It was simmering, I think, at the time we were there and watching it. But the only real trouble which could have happened was in Grenada. But a few sailors were sent ashore, whether they were actual sailors or marines, I don't know. Just died off. So there wasn't any problem. I did have military police under my control. I didn't know whether I mentioned this before.
You mentioned they provided your security.
That's right. I had a couple of British sergeants.
On the gates.
And the rest of them were Jamaicans who they were doing. That's right, yeah. And they provided guards for, well, they didn't, but we had to provide, and I was responsible for ensuring that guards were provided for places like King's House, where the governor was, Trafalgar Park, which was the brigadier's home, and there was an ammunition depot there, an ordnance depot, and they had full-time guards on them. But we didn't have any problems. There were two political parties inside Jamaica at that time. One was led by a great rumbustious character known as Bustamente. His name was Bustamente, and known as Buster by everybody. He used to talk a lot and was very flamboyant. He was had Irish and Spanish blood in him, not very much African. And he had a party which they were more of a union really than a party, but they were called a party. And then his opposite, the other party, was headed by Manley, who was the father of the Manley later who had trouble in Jamaica, who became...
Would that be Michael Manley, the one who came later on?
Yes. I can't remember what his father's name was, Christian name. I don't think we ever got around to it. It was just called Manley. He had an American wife, if I remember. Well, and Jedi Jagan had an American wife as well. So where there's an American wife, it looks as there's always a bit of trouble brewing. but he was much cleverer than Bustamente in many ways. He was a trained barrister and trained by, of course, come over here and done his training. And he was, and later took over from Bustamente. When independence came, Bustamente took over as head of the country, but he was chief, I think he was called chief minister at this time. His party were in power, so to speak. You see, there was an executive council which was headed by the governor with nominated people on it, like the head of commissioner of police and various other people, and then I think there were one or two others who could come in from the local parties. And then there was the legislative council, which was the one where the locals all met and decided on the various policies which they were delegated to them. I mean, they had quite a lot of leeway. I don't think this is understood. They always think the governor sort of stands there and tells everybody what to do, but that's not the case. These people had quite a lot of power, and there was always a bit of tension between them and the governor. And the governor's powers were not overriding all the time over everything.
Presumably, though, he had the right of veto over certain...
Over certain things, yes. But he had to be very careful, because he had to be sure that he didn't upset the local community as well and cause riots.
Did you have direct contact with Manley and Bustamente as part of your work? Or
No. I saw them. I mean, Bustamente was such a character. I mean, he used to have his parades of his people, rag and bobtail, and he used to stand on a balcony in an open shirt and a glass of champagne in his hand as they all marched past underneath, or straggled past underneath. But he was always sort of breathing fire all over the place, but in fact, underneath it all, he was... He didn't really want independence, I don't think. And it, of course, independence didn't come till 1962. And that was another 10 years. So that was sort of local politics. I don't think there's much more I can say about them, really, in this range, 50 years ago.
Were there any extreme political factions or movements in the country which you were aware of at the time?
Any?
Extreme political?
Not really. Factions? I mean, Bustamente was always considered to be extreme, but he wasn't really. I mean, it was what was thought to be extreme. There's nothing like Jagan, for instance. But both of them were realised, both Manley and Bustamente realised that independence was coming one day. And therefore, it was a question of jockeying for position. In actual fact, when independence did come, as I said, Bustamente was the chief minister, so he took over. But he lost an election, I think, later, and Manley took over. And he was a different kettle of fish.
Another factor in internal security in which the military sometimes get involved which has become very prominent in the Caribbean in more recent years, is organised crime, particularly drug smuggling. Was there anything
no.
of that sort of going on?
Drugs wasn't a problem in those days. Not that I was, I'm sure we were aware of it. We had, as I said, we had a security liaison officer with us, or not with us, but he was responsible for the area of Jamaica and the northern part of the Caribbean. Felix, can't remember his Johnson, I think his other name was. He was called SLO, but I mean he was obviously a military MI. And if there'd been any of that sort of thing going on, we would have known through him. But drugs wasn't a problem in those days. There was no smuggling. There probably was, but on a very small scale, and it didn't seem to worry people.
Not enough to have a political impact.
No. Not that we even heard of it, I don't think. I don't seem to remember it. Incidentally, whilst we were in Jamaica at some stage, I became a proper major.
A permanent major,
yes. Because I was when I was allocated this job, I was promoted from captain, which I was in Bedford's, to temporary major again, to take on the job. So at some stage, and I can't remember when it was, I became a proper one, besides being bogus, as I was before. The other thing, of course, that I had when I first got there was there was a lot of social engagements, which I wasn't really used to. There was, I remember the first one I was asked to go to was the Royal Engineer chap, there, Colonel, Lieutenant Colonel, I wish I could remember his name, I can't, who had an American wife. See, they all have American wives, even the brig had an American wife. And I was invited to this party in the evening where I was asked to bring my swimming trunks. And I took my swimming trunks, and I found we were all sitting around a swimming pool with fairy lights and lights under the water and a bar, and everybody sitting back drinking and chatting and diving in for a swim. And having sort of been in England, Burma, all these places where austerity reigned, I found it a bit difficult to come to terms with this sort of way of living. In fact, I sort of remember thinking it was rather decadent. Mind you, I got used to it after a bit and became decadent.
You had become corrupted.
I was corrupted, yes. But I remember my first impression was that this is, you know, how can these people live like this? Lovely, warm, balmy evening, sitting there with the stars and everything. It was very pleasant.
You did say that you got a bit fed up with all the incessant drinking parties in Germany when you were there.
Yes, there wasn't so much here because there were, but you had to be invited into people's. They didn't have these. They had other things to do in Jamaica. I mean, there was plenty of things to go and do. I'm going on the beach for picnics and. People had to live their own lives there and were established there. Germany was a different thing altogether. People were all hugger-mugger inside Badweinhaus, and they got nothing to do in the evening, so they just moved from one house to another and had parties. But, yes, I had one or two there, but I didn't mind them too much because they came at sort of irregular intervals. They were very, very hospitable, the Jamaican people. I managed to get some of them invited me to their houses.
Sounds like you really had a sort of semi-diplomatic role there.
Oh, it was, yes.
Not just a military one.
No, it wasn't at all. I mean, there we were. A lot of my work was with the Navy, the police, the US forces, and the local government. I mean, I remember a little chap called, I always remember him, a little chap called Suter, who was Jamaican. His civil servant, and I did a lot of work with him on sort of getting out schemes for internal security, hurricanes and everything else. And when we had parades of sort through the town, or when we had visiting firemen who had to have cleared roads and things. And he was magnificent. He was really intelligent, hard-working little chap with a great sense of humour, and we got on very well together. So, it wasn't, you know, people get the wrong idea of colonialism. A lot of the work was done by the local people who were very, very good at it when you chose the right people. So in September, I knew this was coming up because I've been warned about it. I was told that I would have to go to the States, USA, to have a meeting with SACLANT's headquarters, Supreme Allied Commander Atlantic, in Norfolk, Virginia. Now, the chap I was taking over from John Sales was still there, waiting for a ship. And when this came up, he was almost beside himself. He said, I've been waiting for this for months to come up, and now I'm going, and you've got it, and I've missed out. You know, he was very envious and I think very disappointed that he hadn't got the chance of going to the States. Well, I mean, going to America in those days was quite an event. It's not like these days where everybody just flies over for a weekend. Anyway, I was told to, first of all, to go to Boston, where the flagship was, and organize myself with the Navy before we went to the meeting. So I flew out from Kingston to Miami, where I was due to get a connection, miss the connection. And I had to go and stay. I found a local hotel I had to go and stay in called, with not much imagination, Miami Hotel.
How did you manage to miss the connection? Was your aircraft late getting in?
Yes, yeah. This is civil aircraft, yeah. I thought it was British West Indian Airways was the one which mostly we used.
Yes.
But I did use Pan American on one or two occasions as well. So, anyway, I missed the flight. I took a trip I remember going around in a bus, and I stopped at I was in uniform, by the way, because they said you're a travelling uniform, otherwise we have to get a visa. So I travelled in uniform. I was sitting in this bus at the bus stop. Windows were open because it was rather hot. There was no air conditioning in the bus. And there was a crowd there, and there was one bloke in the crowd spotted me and waved and said, Hi, he said, I was over your way. And I said, oh, right. I said, where? And he said, Italy. So I said, oh, splendid. He said, have a nice day, and I drove off. I mean, that was the American's idea of being over our way. Just as long as you went to Europe, that was our way. So then the next thing I did was to go into and have, it was 4 o'clock, so it's tea time. So I went into the bar downstairs in the hotel and asked for tea. There was a sort of certain uncertain look, and he said, you like ice? And I said, no, I like it hot tea. And she said, hot tea? You know, it was about 100 outside. So anyway, she got the manager, and he looked at me and said, you really want hot tea? And I said, yes, please. And by this time, all the guys sitting up at the bar with their beers had all turned round and were watching this limey trying to get hot tea.
Like a Bateman cartoon.
Yes, he was. So in the end, they very kindly came up with a great big tray with a silver teapot with a sort of drips of a little thing on the end of the spout, I remember, cream and everything else. And I sat in the corner drinking my tea with all these guys all watching me from the bar. Very embarrassing. Anyway, it's my first experience of air conditioning, because I went in the bedroom and the air conditioning was on, and I sort of woke up in the morning with a thin rime of, ice all over me, but it was really very cold, but quite pleasant. Anyway, I managed to get a flight the next day, which took me up as far as New York. And there I had to stay in the Commodore Hotel, I remember, opposite Grand Central Station. And it was very sticky, so there was no air conditioning in the hotels in those days, so I had to sleep with the window wide open. And somebody in Jamaica who I'd got to know, a civilian, knew somebody in New York. And he said, well, if you're going through New York, contact him, and he'll look after you. I contacted this guy and found he was quite an elderly gentleman. And he said, okay, come on out, you see. And I went out, and I found that he was the chairman of Diamond Sugars, very rich, millionaire. He took me around various places, and everywhere there was diamond sugar on the table. He tipped up the bowl and sort of swept it off the table, said, here, help yourself. And I had my briefcase with me with all the documents, because I had to carry it around. There was nothing else I could do. So I finished up with a briefcase full of sugar. Anyway, he then took me to breakfast, I remember, the next morning at the Union Club. which was the really top club in New York, which mostly was sort of reserved for judges and the hoi polloi. And I remember him saying, I'll give you an English breakfast, and on the tray came up all together, porridge, kippers, scrambled egg, all together on the same time on a tray. So he thought that was English idea of having a breakfast. So one thing I omitted to mention, we had to put down in Cuba on the way up, where I was regarded with the greatest suspicion.
By the Cubans?
Yes, being in uniform. And I had this bag of documents in it. And when I got off the plane, the police took me and beckoned me over and put me into a sort of cell where I could just see the barbed window looking out on the airport. And they put me in there, and I didn't know what was going to happen. I knew that, so far as the Cuban government were concerned, they wouldn't do anything to me at that time. But with my documents, secret documents, which I had, I was very a little bit nervous that some local zealot may not come in and start examining them or taking them away. Anyway, I stayed there for about half an hour, and then they let me out and put me back on the airplane again. I don't know why they did it.
Perhaps seems quite bizarre behaviour.
Well, it was a bit, yes. I don't know. They thought I was going to start a riot or something. I suppose it was because I was in uniform. Anyway, the next thing I did was to catch a train from New York up to Boston. And then I took a taxi, which took me to the port at Boston. And there I wandered around asking everybody where the HMS Superb was. That was the flagship cruiser, which had the Admiral's Commander-in-Chief in it. Eventually, they called it a battle wagon. I mean, I said, have you seen a British warship anywhere? Somebody said, oh, yeah, there's a battle wagon around the corner. So anyway, I eventually found it and got aboard. And they very kindly put me up in the captain's sea cabin, which is right up behind the bridge. And I hadn't been there very long. I think I was there a couple of days. And I met my SO ops again. And we went off. We had time. We went off to have a little trip round and came back again. And then one of the evenings I was there, I was dressing, getting into my mess kit because I'd been eating down in the wardroom. And I was just got my trousers on, fortunately, and the door opened without anybody knocking on it. And a Marine came in, headed by a whole lot of Americans, civilians. It was open day, apparently. And without saying anything to me, he then sort of explained to the crowds craning their heads through the door that this was a British officer changing, ready for his dinner and that sort of thing, and they were all saying, oh, yeah. And they all stood there gawping at me, and nobody asked any questions, so they all disappeared, and he closed the door, and they went. The other thing that I remember in Boston was that the Admiral had been promised a piano for his lower deck sailors if he would march through Boston and stop opposite a big store there, owned by, let's call him Mr. Hamburger for purposes, and present arms. I'm told the Admiral's reply, or what he said to his local, to his staff, was unprintable, the idea of presenting arms to Mr. Hamburger. However, he wanted the piano. So in the end, they came to a compromise, and they marched through Boston with the Marine Band, which was on board, stopped opposite Mr. Hamburger's store, and were addressed by the mayor. And then they proceeded. I went in there, actually, to watch it, and the only thing I can remember, it was a very good, did it very well, and I think the locals were very impressed. And there was one woman standing by me, I remember, who watched them go past and said, oh, ain't that a sight for sore eyes, she said. So I didn't quite know whether it was good or bad when people have sore eyes.
What were you supposed to be discussing with the...
Well, we were going down to Sackland again to talk about the Western approaches to the Panama. I cannot remember exactly what it is. We got an agreement, heads of agreement. So eventually we were introduced to a Colonel...